2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium. Session 223, Sacrificing Principle for Profit, Church Wildlife Enterprises and Hunting Preserves. Participants, Matt Madsen and Ardeen Watts.
Welcome, everyone. I would like to remind everyone that admission to these sessions is by name tag or ticket only, and that tickets can be purchased at the registration table. I'd like to briefly introduce our speaker, Matt Madsen. Matt lives in Ogden with his wife and has three adult children. He has his current title is that he has been well, actually, I don't know if these are your current titles or your previous titles.
Oh, just say I'm a retired professor from Weber State.
Mac is a retired professor from Weber State. He has also taught at the Church College of Hawaii, BYU Hawaii, and he's been an instructor and coach at Weber State and an assistant professor of health promotion and a golf coach. He has his degrees from BYU and from the University of Utah. I'd like to welcome Mac.
I believe we're very fortunate to have the Sunstone Symposium, a place where those seeking truth and pursuing intelligent discipleship may discuss doctrine, raise questions and issues, and even debate and challenge church policy. I would like to thank the Sunstone Board of Directors for allowing me to present my views on what I consider to be a very important subject. I'd like to thank Ardell and Ardeen for being part of this program, and mention that in the course of this discussion, I may refer to certain scriptures or certain other commentaries made by previous church prophets in the church in a little book called Put Away Your Guns, Brethren. It's 20 years old, but chapters 2, 3, and 4 will allow you to have a ready reference to any of the scriptures that I mentioned and some of the things, that, particularly those of Joseph Smith, Joseph Fielding Smith, and Joseph F. Smith. You're welcome to take one of those with you at no cost. I've just had them collected in my garage for some time now. When I read Cecil Francis Alexander's well-known poem, All Things Bright and Beautiful, All Creatures Great and Small, All Things Wise and Wonderful, The Lord God Made Them All, I ask myself why. Why did the Lord God make them all? When God declared that man should have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over everything that moveth upon the earth, I'm certain he didn't have in mind some of the cruel, mean, abusive, and indefensible practices we observe today in the relationship between humans and God's animal creations. In his essay, Subduing the Earth, Professor Hugh Nibley asks, why does it seem to be man's nature to at times despise all things beneath him and exterminate all creatures that yield no return or have cash value in order to make way for the creatures that do? As humans, we are not born with any natural instincts to prey upon and destroy animal life. Our negative behavior directed towards these creations must be learned. Nibley relates the following story to emphasize this point. One morning, just after we had moved into our house on 7th North in Provo, as I was leaving for work, I found a group of shouting, arm-waving boys gathered around a big fir tree in the front yard. They had sticks and stones, and in a state of high excitement were fiercely attacking the lowest branches of the tree, which hung to the ground. Why? I asked. There was a quail in the tree, they said in breathless zeal. A quail? Of course, said I. What is wrong with that? But don't you see, they said, it's a live quail, a wild one. So they just had to kill it. They were on their way to the old BYU High and were Boy Scouts. Does this story surprise you? What surprised me was when I later went to Chicago and saw squirrels running around the city parks in broad daylight, I thought to myself, they would not last a day in Provo. Interestingly, during the last U.S. Open golf tournament, I want to relate this story because I'm an old golf coach, on the 12th green in the middle of the tournament, I think it was either a fox or a squirrel, something of that nature, ran across the green while Nick Faldo, the renowned British player, along with others, were putting out on the green. And as the rodent or squirrel ran across the green, Nick Faldo raised up his putter in a simulation of shooting a rifle and gave the little, whatever it was, a couple of shots. Not because he hated it, it's just a learned behavior that he had picked up. When dealing with the subject of man's relationship with animals, sometimes people, even general authorities, seem to just miss the mark. A regional representative once spoke at a state conference I attended in Ogden. He told of his recent trip to Africa on church business. He went on a hunting safari where a lion was wounded, and he and others had to track down the lion and destroy it. He told of harvesting a rare Roman antelope during that safari. Later that night, he made quite a point of the fact that during an evening social, he had the moral integrity to turn down an alcoholic beverage called a sundowner. What peculiar priorities. At the present time, there is a foul, F-O-W-L, odor coming from Utah Lake, and it isn't dead fish. I'm afraid someone has again missed the mark. Sacrificing principle for profit. Church Wildlife Enterprises and Hunting Preserves is the title of this paper. Or as my wife, Lori, who has a special way with words, would put it, what the hell is going on down at Utah Lake? Through its farm management company, under the direction of the presiding bishopric, the LDS Church is involved in the operation of over 300 ranches and farms around the world. Some of these are called wildlife enterprises. They are, in fact, revenue-generating hunting preserves, owned, operated, and sanctioned by church leadership. For now, I would like to briefly describe just one of these operations, the Westlake Farm Commercial Hunting Area, located just down the freeway in Utah County. On July 10, 2000, the Deseret News ran a lengthy article entitled Westlake Wildlife, LDS Missionary Couple, you see them over here, operate church-owned hunting preserve. The article essentially states that missionaries Claire and Beth Huff were called to clear an area along the southwest shore of the lake, plant corn, rye, and other grains in order to entice geese, pheasants, ducks, chuckers, and doves to come and feed. Permits were then sold to hunters for as much as $1,500 so they could come and harvest or kill the birds. How could one best describe the reaction of most serious students of LDS history and doctrine to this hunting preserve enterprise? Choose from these: incredulous, appalling, unbelievable, unfathomable. I will come back to Westlake Wildlife later. I would just like to say that for me and many others, this church business venture brashly condones the sacrifice of some of God's special creatures for the sole purpose of making money for a church that is already estimated to be worth $30 billion. Why are they doing this, and how can such blatant greed be justified? I hope a brief review of some relevant scriptures and the teachings of Joseph Smith and other early church leaders will help answer these three basic questions concerning the issue. A, what is the grand design and purpose of God's animal creations? B, what should our relationship be to the kingdom of creatures? And C, are the philosophies and practices at Westlake and Deseret Land and Livestock consistent with answers to A and B? In researching this question, I have found Professor Hugh Nibley's essay, Subduing the Earth, in his book On the Timely and the Timeless, an invaluable resource. The emphasis God places on the sacredness and preservation of human life should suggest to us that the preservation and care of all life forms within the sphere of his creations should be of utmost concern to all of us. What do we really know about the ultimate and eternal purpose and destiny of the Lord's bird, fish, and other animal creations? God did say that all of his creations were good, and they should be allowed to have joy in their earthly environment and fill the full measure of their creation. We are taught that the day will come when the enmity of man, beasts, even all flesh, shall cease from before his face, and all forms of life will come forth in the resurrection. At the completion of the creation period, the Lord stated that man should have dominion over the fish, fowl, and everything that moved upon the earth. Many questions and much confusion have arisen relative to our dominion over the animal kingdom. One man who has investigated this question in great depth is Professor Hugh Nibley. One of the major themes in Nibley's work, Subduing the Earth, is the interpretation of the word dominion as used in the creation scriptures of Genesis, Abraham, and Moses. Understanding what God had in mind when he said we should have dominion over the beasts is paramount to understanding the whole concept of our relationship with these creations. Dr. Nibley's explanation leads first to an examination of Genesis 1:28. And God blessed them, Adam and Eve, and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Some have misinterpreted what was meant by subduing and exercising dominion. According to Dr. Nibley, this scripture clearly suggests two very distinguishable areas of responsibility for Adam and Eve and their posterity. First, we are to understand that the earth itself is a storehouse and a source of life, which Adam and Eve are to replenish or keep filled. In addition, we must be concerned about the creatures over which we have been given dominion. Nibley states that the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis sheds new light on the subject. The same Genesis 1:28 is restated more accurately in Moses 5:1. And it came to pass that after I, the Lord God, had driven them out, that Adam began to till the earth and have dominion over the beasts of the field and to eat his bread by the sweat of his brow. The King James Version, subdue, is replaced by the inspired translation, till, applied to the earth alone, while dominion is reserved for man's relationship with the animal kingdom. This eliminates any impression that may have been formed from Genesis that we should subdue the creatures and raise the question, exactly what is dominion then? Dr. Nibley, master of derivatives in language, traces the scriptural meaning of dominion. From dominion, derivative of dominium, meaning property or ownership, from dominus, or lord, specifically lord of the household, and domus, owner of the house, Nibley explains, after commanding every form of life to multiply for the purpose of having joy, God gave the identical command to Adam and Eve, and at the same time put them in charge of the whole operation, making Adam lord over the whole earth and giving him dominion over everything on the face of the earth. Conclusion, lordship and dominion are the same, and lordship is akin to stewardship. Both words imply that rather than subduing, dominating, beating down, or hunting the creatures for sport, we should be their caretakers and try to assist them to achieve their destiny. As Dr. Nibley puts it, man is not a predator, a manipulator, or an exploiter of the creatures, but one who cooperates with nature as a diligent husbandman. We can be assured of a day of accountability. It is not well known that, according to Joseph Fielding Smith, permission to utilize flesh of animals and birds for food was first given after the landing of Noah's Ark. The initiation of such a practice adds an important dimension to our total lordship and stewardship responsibility. Permission to use animals and fowl for food did not come without stringent restrictions. The earliest statement regarding these restrictions is found in Genesis 9:3-5. The King James Version of these scriptures is very confusing. The inspired translation, Genesis 9:9-11, is much clearer. In verse 11 specifically is found both the basic qualification for using animals for food and the accompanying lordship restriction. The three verses of inspired Genesis 9:9-11 read as follows. Every moving thing that liveth upon that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb I have given you all things. But the blood of all flesh which I have given you for meat shall be shed upon the ground, which taketh life thereof, and the blood ye shall not eat. And surely blood shall not be shed only for meat to save your lives, and the blood of every beast will I require at your hands. The interpretation of verse 9 seems very clear. Their blood must not be shed only to provide us with the necessary elements for sustaining life, and the needless killing of these creatures will have to be justified before God, their creator. Another very significant scripture that needs to be reviewed is found in the Doctrine and Covenants. While it's true that the reference made in section 89 relative to using meat sparingly is instructive, it is in section 49 that the Lord's position on the use of animals for food is given in unambiguous language. Verses 19 and 21 read as follows. For behold, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air and that which cometh on the earth is ordained for use of man for food and raiment, and that he might have an abundance. But woe be unto man that sheddeth blood, or that wasteth flesh, and hath no need. The Doctrine and Covenants commentary elaborates further on these verses. But although God has ordained animals for the use of man, he has not sanctioned the order of things under which some have an abundance of food and clothing, while others are destitute. For this reason, the world lieth in sin. Nor must we waste animal life. To kill when not necessary is a sin akin to murder. Man has been entrusted with sovereignty over the animal kingdom, that he may learn to govern as God rules by the power of love and justice, and fit for his eternal destiny as a ruler of worlds. A tyrant who has learned nothing but selfishness and cruelty can hope for no position of trust hereafter in the kingdom of the Father. Professor Nibley summarizes these scriptures in Genesis and the Doctrine and Covenants beautifully. Man's dominion is a call to service, not a license to exterminate. It is precisely because men now prey upon each other and shed the blood and waste the flesh of other creatures without need that the world lieth in sin. Such, at least, is the teaching of the ancient Jews and of modern Revelation. Speaking again about the purpose of these creations and man's hand-in-hand eternal progression with the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdoms, Nibley states, "We are all going to move together into the eternities, and even now look forward to heaven, the paradise of God, the happiness of man, and of beasts, and of creeping things, and of the fowls of the air, that which is spiritual being in the likeness of his person, as also the spirit of beast and every creature with God, which God has created. What an admonition to proceed with reverence and care. It is only because Latter-day Saints are ignorant of these things, according to President Young, that God has not already cursed them for their brutal and callous treatment of God's other creatures." In addition to the scriptures, a perusal of significant statements made by prophets of the church regarding this subject is very critical in attempting to ascertain a definitive church doctrine. Those who spoke out most forcefully on this issue were Joseph Smith, Joseph F. Smith, Joseph Fielding Smith, and to a certain degree, and more recently, Spencer W. Kimball. Very early in the history of the church, Joseph Smith revealed some of his feelings about this teaching during an incident that occurred at Zion's camp. According to Joseph, "We crossed the Embarrass River and encamped on a small branch of the same about a mile west. In pitching our tent, we found 3 prairie rattlesnakes, which the brethren were about to kill. But I said, 'Let them alone, don't hurt them. How will a serpent ever lose his venom while the servants of God possess the same disposition and continue to make war against it? Man must become harmless before the brute creation, and when men lose their vicious dispositions and cease to destroy the animal race, the lion and the lamb can dwell together, and the suckling child can play with the serpent in safety. The brethren took the serpents carefully on sticks and carried them across the creek. I exhorted the brethren not to kill a serpent, bird, or an animal of any kind during our journey unless it became necessary in order to preserve ourselves from hunger." Many years ago, President Joseph F. Smith gave this counsel to the youth of the church. "I have just a few words to say in addition to those that already have been said in relation to shedding blood and to the destruction of life. In reference to the killing of our innocent birds, it is not only wicked to destroy them, it is abominable in my opinion. I think that this principle should extend not only to bird life, but to the life of all animals. I never could see why man should be imbued with the bloodthirsty desire to kill and destroy animal life. I have known men, and they still exist among us, who enjoy what is to them the sport of hunting birds and slaying them by the hundreds. I do not believe anyone should kill animals or birds unless they need them for food. I believe it is wicked for men to thirst in their souls to kill almost everything which possesses animal life. It is wrong. I have been surprised that prominent men whom I have seen, whose very souls seem to be athirst for shedding blood of animal life, they go off hunting deer, antelope, elk, or anything they can find. And what for? Just for the fun of it. Not because they're hungry and need the flesh of their prey, but just because they love to shoot and destroy life. I am a firm believer in the simple words of one of the poets, "Take not away the life you cannot give, for all things have an equal right to live." Joseph Fielding Smith made these comments about the previously discussed Genesis 9:9-11. "The inferences in this interpretation are that the use of flesh of living creatures should be indulged in sparingly, although there is no sin for the shedding of their blood when required for food. There is no inference in the scriptures that it is the privilege of man to slay birds or beasts or catch fish wantonly. The Lord gave life to every creature. It is intended all creatures should be happy in their several elements. Therefore, to take the life of these creatures wantonly is a sin before God." He also felt the need to add this statement of clarification to that "hath no need" scripture in Doctrine and Covenants 49. "It is a grievous sin in the sight of God to kill merely for sport. Such a thing shows a weakness in the spiritual character of the individual. We cannot restore life when it's taken, and all creatures have the right to enjoy life and happiness on the earth where God has placed them, only for food, and then sparingly should flesh be eaten, for all is from God and is eternal. The most recent instruction church members received regarding this important doctrinal matter was from President Spencer W. Kimball during October Conference 1978. During his address, Kimball voiced the same concern as previous church presidents, namely the unnecessary shedding of blood and the needless destruction of life. He also reiterated the timeless admonition that the principle of respect for life should be extended not only to bird life, but to the life of all animals. He stated that the righteous use of buffalo meat by pioneers and others during that period was justified, but indicated that the days of the buffalo hunt should be over. He finished this talk with a biting attack on trophy hunting. President Kimball's remarks caused such a backlash that a much softer capitulatory statement was released via the Church News on October 7, 1978, as follows. The decision to hunt and fish under appropriate regulations is left to the discrimination of the individual. However, many clear guidelines have been supplied to assist those who may be involved in such activities. These guidelines are designed to stop the unnecessary and wasteful slaughter of animals and birds, not to define public policy on predator control and game management. I wanted to say, come on, President Kimball. Who intimidated you? Why did you retreat? Why are you so vague and so weak in a statement relative to this issue? Why did you change so much from the time you gave your address to a few days later when you gave a press release? Were you afraid you were going to offend someone? And if so, who would it be? Not liberals, intellectuals, and homosexuals for sure, because they're the only people that the church doesn't seem to care about offending. I wondered why President Kimball retracted, why President Hinckley has gone 20-something years and not followed up in any way, why we don't find lessons in manuals, in the priesthood quorums, and other places where we can use the influence of church leadership to alter attitudes. It might even bring about better gun control in Utah. Instead of being at the last of the list, maybe we'd be at the top, and maybe we wouldn't have such places as Westlake Hunting Preserve going on down in Utah County. Another problem with the statement for me that was released is that the guidelines referred to in the statement, the guidelines we have been discussing here for the last 15 minutes, are, in my view, completely incompatible with the type of management being practiced in part at Deseret Life and Landstock and in total at the Westlake Hunting Preserve. And the policies in effect at these enterprises are not public policies, they are church policies implemented on church property in church programs. To my knowledge, there have been no conference talks or policy statements by general authorities regarding this issue for the past 23 years. With what's going on in northern Utah, that's where Deseret Land and Livestock is, and at Utah Lake, this doesn't come as any surprise to me. I'd like to conclude this part of the paper with a 6-point summary. Number one, God's animal creations. Who and what are they? Several million species with possible forms of life infinite when considering other worlds without end. Speaking about John's visions of beasts recorded in Revelations 4 and 5, Joseph Smith states, I suppose John saw beings there in heaven of 1,000 forms that had been saved from 10,000 times 10,000 earths like this, strange beasts of which we have no conception. All might be seen in heaven. From Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith, pages 291 and 2. Point 2, temporal purpose of these creations. For behold, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air and that which cometh of the earth is ordained for use of man and for food and raiment that he might have in abundance, Doctrine and Covenants 49. 3, present use of flesh for food is conditional. Yea, flesh of beasts and the fowls of the air, I, the Lord, have ordained for the use of man with thanksgiving. Nevertheless, they are to be used sparingly. Doctrine and Covenants 89. Point 4. The relationship of humans to other creatures. Dominion should be interpreted as lordship. Lordship is akin to stewardship. We should be their caretakers. Our role is a call to service, cooperating with nature, so these creations may fulfill their destined purposes. Think of it this way. Those in the animal kingdom are on earth to fulfill their purposes within their sphere, much as we are on earth to fulfill ours within our sphere, and we're marching along parallel, and it is not our prerogative to prevent them from meeting their expectations any more than it would be for them to mess up ours. 5, accountability. I, the Lord, make every man accountable as a steward over earthly blessings, which I have made and prepared for my creatures, Doctrine and Covenants 104. And surely blood shall not be shed, only for meat to save your lives, and the blood of every beast will I require at your hands, inspired Genesis 9. Man has been entrusted with sovereignty over the animal kingdom, that he may learn to govern as God rules, by the power of love and justice, and fit for the eternal worlds as rulers of eternal destiny as rulers of worlds, Doctrine and Covenants. Commentary, page 36. Grand design and purpose of the animal creations, from Teachings of the Prophet, pages 291 and 2, referring to Revelation 4 and 5, and I like this a lot. The grand secret was to show John what there was in heaven. John learned that God glorified himself by saving all that his hands had made, whether beast, fowls, fishes, or men, and he will glorify himself with them. John heard the words of the beast, could understand them, giving glory to God. God, who made the beast, could understand every language spoken by them. The four beasts were four of the noblest animals that had filled the measure of their creation and had been saved from other worlds because they were perfect. They were like angels in their sphere. We are not told where they came from, and I do not know, but they were seen and heard by John, praising and glorifying God. If the answer to question 1, what is the grand design and purpose of God's animal creations, is to glorify God, and if the answer to question 2, what should our relationship be to the kingdom of creatures, is we should be their caretakers, lords, stewards, implementing a call to service, and our dominion over the creatures carries with it strict accountability. How, then, do we assess what is going on at places like Westlake Hunting Preserve and Deseret Life and Landstock? I'm going to give you a few more details about these two operations and let you decide if the church is, in fact, sacrificing principle for profit. Deseret Land and Livestock is located up in the Monte Cristo area on the way to Woodruff. Woodruff is kind of the headquarters of the place. It's established in 1891 as a sheep grazing area, 200,000 acres. Owned and operated by a farm management company, a tax-paying entity of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the ranch mission statement is to, 1, make a profit while maintaining or enhancing the resource. This property was purchased by the church in 1983 with the Wildlife Enterprise Program intact. I think the second part of the mission statement, maintaining and enhancing the resource, is completely overshadowed by the first and primary purpose, which is to make a profit. If you look at the costs that I just got this sheet from Deseret Land and Livestock within the last 2 weeks. The permit costs, a guided bull elk, 5-day hunts occurring September through October, trophy bulls harvested, average a 330 Boone and Crockett gross score. The cost of one guided trophy hunt in 2001 is $11,500 plus tax and license. A guided management bull elk, an adjusted type of a tour, the cost is $6,500 plus tax and license. A guided archery bull elk, guided archery elk hunts are 9 days, one-on-one hunts September 7 through 15. The cost is $9,000 plus tax and license. This is our premier elk hunt. We are one of, if not the top place to archery elk hunt. The guided moose cost $10,000. Guided deer, $7,500. Antelope, $3,000 plus tats, etc. The costs seem, the income that comes in from Deseret Land and Livestock through these guided tours seems to be completely at the front of the purpose of having Deseret Land and Livestock even exist. The most recent one, the church didn't even try to scoot this by anyone. It's in their own newspaper, the Deseret News. It appears As I mentioned back in July of 2000, I just want to highlight a few things from that enterprise down there, and then you can I can tell you a website. You can get this information in detail if it interests you. I don't even know how many of you are aware that such a wildlife preserve exists. I don't know if you know that in Florida, the largest of the farms, ranches owned by the church, they've leased it out to a hunting club. Those things are maybe one step removed from what's going on, in my opinion, at Westlake, because this is a blatant kind of in-your-face, we are going to raise the grain, bring in the birds, bring in the permits with the hunters, and we're going to raise huge amounts of money, and we're not even trying to manage anything. All we're trying to do is get the place ready, bring the birds in, go shoot them, and get the money. It's even a little bit different than up at Deseret Land and Livestock, where they're at least managing some of the wildlife up there. For more than 2 years, he and his wife, Beth, have been serving God in a most unusual way. They operate a private hunting preserve owned by the LDS Church. We run the checking station, where hunters come in to gain admittance to a private preserve and where they must register the number of birds and other wildlife they take when they leave. With thousands of birds flocking to the property in search of food, particularly during the fall hunting season, hunters stand a prime chance of harvesting or killing their limit, but they pay dearly for the privilege, up to $1,500. The place has become fast becoming an exclusive club for members only. Once a hunter ponies up the cash to secure a permit, he's not only guaranteed a permit for the following year, but his chance to draw the prime target areas for the preserve improve, along with his seniority in the exclusive group. All of our hunters are from Utah, many of them doctors, dentists, and attorneys from Payson north to Ogden, including Park City, Huff says. The flatlands also provide an additional advantage to the well-heeled hunting crowd, a 2,600-foot landing strip where private aircraft can whisk hunters in and out of the remote preserve, saving them the long and lonely drive. Well, he says, the preserve will continue to grow. Boosting the number of hunting permits that can be issued to harvest the wildlife is one of their prime goals. Just like the farm derives revenue from harvesting crops, the preserve is designed to produce revenue when hunters harvest the wildlife here. Pull no bones about what the purpose is. He goes on to say that, you know, hunting and guns are a big issue. This is just like a recreational thing. It's kind of like he said, some people like to go camping. We're offering them a chance to come here and do some recreational hunting. Not that they need the pheasants or geese or anything. Just kind of a shooting gallery. The hunting on the preserve is so popular, there's a six-year waiting list to buy a permit. Elder Huff is optimistic about turning a profit. And in the future, he says, this is a very viable habitat. If they continue to invest, they, meaning the first presidency, the presiding bishopric, if they continue to invest the profits back in and find an innovative manager to run it, there's the potential to boost the number of permits we issue up to a maximum of about 250 someday. As the habitat continues to grow, the price of the permits will go up. Imagine, he says, quote, if we got to the point that we could boost the price of each permit to $2,500, times that by 250 people with permits, and it doesn't take a lot to understand this could be a very profitable operation. I did the math on my calculator. 250 times 2,500 is $625,000 a year. My opinion is that operations like Deseret Land and Livestock in Westlake contradict the teachings of the scriptures and many former church presidents, are repulsive to most truly compassionate people, and are an affront to God, the creator of the kingdom of creatures. If Westlake had been designed to raise crops to feed the homeless and families living in poverty, it would make a great deal of sense. I find the profit motive in these church enterprises very objectionable. Is it possible that 1,600 years ago, Moroni saw this coming? While prophesying concerning the conditions that would prevail among churches in our time, he foresaw this near obsession for churches to be involved in making money. From the 8th chapter of Mormon in the Book of Mormon, verse 33, why have ye built up churches unto yourself to get gain? Verse 37, For behold, ye do love money and your substance, and the adorning of your churches more than ye love the poor, the needy, the sick, and the afflicted. Verse 38, why have ye polluted the holy church of God? During the summer of 2000, I wrote personal letters to H. David Burton, Richard C. Edgley, and Keith B. McMillan of the Presiding Bishopric, asking for an explanation or rationale for this peculiar missionary calling and the program at Westlake Hunting Preserve. I received no response. As a member of the church, I strenuously object to the enterprises at Deseret Land and Livestock and Westlake. In this semi-public Sunstone Symposium Forum, I call upon the presiding bishopric and their superiors to get out of the money-making business through church-owned and operated hunting preserves. Thank you.
I'd like to quickly introduce our Dean Watts, who is the respondent to this session.
Got to put this on.
Good idea.
Well, thank you very much, Mac, for those stimulating words about something that I share similar passion for. The paper we've heard raises issues which appear to me as important as any on any table, and my attitudes on them to a large extent determine my politics, how I use my time and money, and my lifestyle. I share Brother Madsen's passion and compassion for the creatures with whom we share this planet. My response will be largely autobiographical and reflect my personal experience more than they do any academic research on my part. The best moments I spent with my father as I was growing up were hunting and fishing. When it came time for me to set a pattern for my own life, one of my first decisions was to give up hunting and fishing. I adopted knowing and eating wild mushrooms and bird washing as alternatives that would put me into close contact with wild places frequently. When it came time to make further and more drastic changes in my life, about the time of the birth of our eighth child, among other things, I became a vegetarian for a period of about 15 years. I was motivated mostly by lingering guilt associated with a wanton taking of life under my father's tutelage. That was 27 years ago. After 15 years as a vegetarian, I felt I had arrived at a point that I could eat flesh again on a limited basis. That sequence of experiences is germane to the issues raised by Brother Madsen. I was not a purist in the way that I practiced vegetarianism. I continued to eat dairy products, wear leather shoes, belts, and I continued to step on ants and kill mosquitoes that chose to suck my blood. But I wrestled constantly with drawing the lines. One of my closest friends happens to be an executive within the farm management company mentioned in Mac's paper. I have toured the Deseret Livestock Ranch in northern Utah and recently visited the Deseret Livestock and Citrus Ranch in Florida, another LDS-owned ranch which he's already referred to. And furthermore, I rode an airboat on the river which constitutes the northern border of that ranch near Orlando, Florida, and saw the banks literally move with thousands of alligators as our boat passed by. The manager informed me that the ranch obtained significant revenue from the sale of hunting permits for trophy alligators and white-tailed deer that live on the LDS church property. I have attended several Sunstone sessions this year wherein panelists referred to life as messy. I think we all wrestle, sometimes mightily, with the messy parts of life, where to draw lines in our behavior. I have long ago given up expecting consistency in my own actions, and also more, I might say, in others. As a long-time conservationist and environmentalist, I found myself in very strange relationships with developers, hunters, firearm advocates. I paid dues to over a dozen environmental organizations. Most of these groups would cease to exist except for the strange bedfellows with whom they sleep. The Division of Wildlife and the Duck Clubs, for instance, mutually dependent. The environmental easements held by Kennecott Copper account for the main non-public protection for wildlife habitat around the Great Salt Lake. So there are a lot of inconsistencies out there, and how do we live with these? I see the issue in two parts. One, what do we demand of ourselves? And two, what do we expect of the institutions to which we belong? I don't recommend my solution to any of you here. Incidentally, I thank the 11 of you for choosing this session. I have reduced my expectations as to how the church should act to a virtual and perhaps absolute minimum. I don't look to them, the church, for guidance or example in the areas in which I care the most. Music. I happen to be a professional musician. That includes other arts as well. Nature, about which I am just as passionate, and even my family. In reducing my expectations for them, I found I empowered myself. I don't pay a full tithing to the LDS Church, but I contribute substantially to organizations that support the causes I do care the most about. About 50 of them, ranging from SUWA, a name some of you will recognize, the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, CHOICE, a humanitarian effort, the Utah Symphony, Tree Utah, you don't need to know them. But I'm trying to say that there are no restrictions on the number of groups that can indeed, that are willing to follow an agenda that fits with our consciences. I speak my mind regarding the causes I espouse whenever I find a listening ear, including the rare moments when I go to church. My attitude has become, over time, if not me, whom, and if not now, when. My view of the church is that, like our family, it is a human institution, which at best can be divinely inspired, but most of the time is imperfect in its application of principles and conscience in the areas of daily life. While I don't condone what Deseret Livestock does, it is one of the most environmentally responsible operations of its kind in the world. That is employing grazing practices, which does indeed preserve. It's equally innovative. They are not perfect. I am not perfect. We are both trying. I think we need credit for that. Mormonism is perhaps better defined by how its adherents live than by the tradition or even scriptures. And I do appreciate the many stimulating statements that Brother Madsen has put on the table today appertaining to this issue. the lack of dialogue about environmental issues within the LDS Church today is an indicator of the indifference many Latter-day Saints feel toward those issues. You are the choir. You came. Hundreds have not. The voting records of the state's most powerful political leaders speak for themselves. Brothers Hatch, Bennett, Hansen, Cannon, Levitt, the Utah legislature in general, being prime examples. More pertinent, how do Mormons vote on environment issues? What is said in general conference and in church media about the subject? I thank God that there are a few exceptions, very few, and thank you for calling our attention to them. People's beliefs matter a lot. They have observable consequences. New readings of stewardship and dominion are important. But consider the environmental and human impact of the 1969 statement from President McKay, during President McKay's presidency, in a statement from the first presidency concerning birth control. We seriously regret that there should exist a sentiment or feeling among any members of the church to curtail the birth of their children. This was not a casual statement in a casual place. This was a statement of the first presidency printed on the first page of the Deseret News. In 1972, President Lee echoed that sentiment. We declare it is a grievous sin before God to adopt restrictive measures in disobedience to God's divine command from the beginning of time to multiply and replenish the earth, end of quote. Human population pressure is at the forefront of disappearing life forms and habitats all over the planet. I have a personal letter in my files from Senator Hatch saying population is not a problem. The reasons Utah has the youngest population of any state in the union are well known to all of us. A large population of faithful Latter-day Saints takes precedence over population pressures amongst Mormons. Though many LDS women choose not to follow strong admonitions like that against birth control, these policies dominate LDS attitudes and prevent action, where I think it would do the most good. Millenarianism, that is, the belief in the imminence of the second coming of Christ, appears to be on the wane based on how infrequently it is spoken of nowadays in church fora. However, it continues to play a determining role in deterring Mormons from assuming responsibilities for their stewardship over the land and its inhabitants. The attitude that in the great plan the earth shall be renewed and receive its paradisiacal glory without any effort on their part, I might add, not indeed included in that article of faith, still mitigates any urgency many Latter-day Saints feel to become involved in environmental issues. Christ will tend, pardon me, Christ will fix it if it's broken. He will tend to the unfinished business we humans have accumulated through our thoughtlessness and irresponsibility, and the earth will be cleansed by fire. No need to worry about toxic waste and nuclear half-life. In practical terms, the practice of paying tithing by faithful church members restricts the amount of money given by church members in charitable contributions to nonprofit organizations. In recent years, the church has increased the amounts of resources allotted to non-LDS humanitarian causes worldwide. To my knowledge, there is no significant amount of support given by the church for environmental issues. Charitable contributions to nonprofits is by far the largest source of revenue for environmental projects. The church's public announcement of opposition to the racetrack mode ballistic missiles. This is before your life, but many of you will remember that event. The church opposition virtually killed the project nationwide a generation ago. One single sentence spoken by the prophet. It can be imagined that similar public support for responsible stewardship of wildlife and wilderness resources by the LDS Church would have considerable impact, both in Utah and nationwide. However, I cannot hold them to a more rigorous practice than I do myself. But I would hope that they, like myself, would keep trying. Thank you.
Thank you, Ardeen and Beth. I want to just mention that tapes of the session will be available in the book area, and please help yourselves to these pamphlets. Put away your guns, brethren, provided by Mac Madsen. Again, thank you for coming.
You want to ask if there are any questions?
Oh, yes. Are there any questions?
We
do have about 5 minutes. Are there any questions either for Mac or Ardeen?
When have they started these preserves, and how long have they been in power?
Okay, the question was, when were these two preserves started?
I can tell you that Deseret Land and Livestock, and Ardeen may know more about that. He's been there. From the information they sent me in the mail just recently, it says the Deseret Land and Livestock was established in 1891, and has existed for a great number of years, and it was purchased by the church in 1983 with the Wildlife Enterprise Program intact. The other one is very new. I don't even think they had calculated revenue from the first year's operation. The article in the Deseret News came out in July of 2000, so this is a harvesting of wildlife operation that just began, say, within the last year and a half. Maybe the preparations of the land and the planting, but from what I'm reading, they're expecting to start making some big-time money with getting a permit, waiting list now at 6 years. Everything's on a roll. I mean, all you have to do is just keep planting the grains every year, and the birds are going to come back. So one is quite old, and one is very, very new.
And then a follow-up, where do these revenues go? Do you know what
I don't know where they go, and I don't think anyone would have any luck trying to find out, because the management of money is so secretive these days that who knows where your tithing money goes? Who knows where the revenue from these? The church is such a giant corporate enterprise now that it. I remember years ago, long before you were probably even born, when we used to go to state presidents and attend semiannual conferences. A secretary of the church would get up, and they would divulge. This is how much tithing money came in. These are the main areas of expenditures, and it kind of made you feel like you were part of the whole process. I mean, it's my money. Where does it go? But I think everything is so sealed at this point that you'd have a very difficult time finding out any details about where the money goes. Obviously, a little bit of it goes back into to the operation, but the vast majority of it, I think, just goes into a pool that could be used for anything from restoring the Nauvoo Temple to sending information to stop the same-sex marriage unions in Nebraska. I don't know where it goes.
Would a part of their success be the fact that they are a church and that they are exempt from taxes like church properties are?
I would guess so. Ardeen, do you?
I think the Deseret Livestock is a tax-paying entity.
It says here it is a tax-paying entity.
All the farm management ranches are tax-paying.
I don't have a problem. Personally, I don't have a problem with the management. I don't have a problem with the tax entity thing. I have a problem with what Brother Nibley interprets to be Latter-day Saints basically just don't understand, I think, the magnitude of the responsibility and problem with wildlife, game, and what they're doing down at Westlake now just pulls no bones about. They are doing the grain to bring the birds, to bring the hunters, to make the money. To me, that's not management. That's a profit motive enterprise, and I find it very objectionable.
Which one of those elements would you eliminate? Is it the money making? If that were eliminated, would that make it an acceptable enterprise?
Not if they continued to use the land to entice birds to come and still kill the birds. I object to that as well as the fact that it's making money. What I would rather have them do is go plant some things that can be manufactured into foodstuffs that could be taken to charitable organizations and help alleviate poverty in the state. I mean, we don't do very well in that respect.
So if the animals, the birds, once they were harvested, if that could be channeled then into foodstuffs that would feed others, would that make it acceptable?
The question was, if the animals or the birds in this case could be harvested for the purpose of processing to take to people who were in need and everything, would that make it okay for me? Only partially so, because I'd much rather them raise other kinds of crops that didn't involve the slaughter of pheasants and geese and so on, simply because I don't know if that's part of the intent of why God placed the creatures here to provide access for hunters to come and hunt and then turn the process.
The issue where the same amount of land, if it were used to raise grain,
corn,
could feed more or whatever,
yeah,
could feed more people than the same amount of land that's used to feed an animal that is then used. Is that the concept?
Well, for me, yeah. If they would convert this property they're using for the purpose that it's being used for now into a type of agricultural fruit farm kind of a thing where the food could be used to bring to places charitable organizations, I'd volunteer to go down and help work on the farm. But I wouldn't set foot on the place as it's operated now with the philosophy that prevails.
Question that I want your response to, something I struggle with, that if we purchase meat at the store, we're essentially paying somebody else to commit the act of murder of those animals. Is it more moral for us to do it ourselves with wildlife or any other animal, or is it more moral to pay somebody to do it for us?
The question has to do with what if we buy meats, fowl, commercially from the market? Is that a lot different and putting the responsibility on someone else who has to do it? What I write in this book when that question came up was that, to me, there's a vast difference in a person who puts on the hunting cap and puts on the jacket and takes the 12-gauge out and is tromping through with his heart beating about 150 beats a minute, and he's got this huge, powerful weapon that gives him some kind of a power that he doesn't have as a school teacher or something. I see the whole emotional and intellectual involvement with hunting for the sport, for the food. Then I'm reminded of when I lived in Hawaii and taught over there, there was a pig slaughtering house right on a right turn of one of the holes on the golf course I used to play. And we'd frequently hit balls out into that area and have to pass close by this operation. We'd look in and see the hogs going along on an apparatus up above, and the workers there would take this steel rod and methodically, like they were at an assembly plant in Detroit, with all the emotion of a flat line, just insert the steel rod up into the carotid artery of the pig and go on to the next one while the previous pig died. And I see a huge difference in what the prophets were saying about we must lose our vicious nature with the brute creation. We must, I just see a big difference to me and we try to restrain use of meats anyway, but I see a huge difference in buying a commercial outlet than going out and going through that process emotionally.
Thank you for your questions, and also thank you to the presenters. We'll need